This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 8, the geopolitical arena, part 1.
The Israelite people in the Old Testament, especially, and also in the New Testament, lived in a larger political, geopolitical arena as well. And we have to understand, too, that in the biblical period, the Kingdom of Israel, Kingdom of Judah, were very, very small kingdoms, regional kingdoms, local kingdoms, but they were existing in a much larger framework of global empires. And the first empire we were going to talk about is Egypt, and then we'll talk about the Mesopotamian empires of Assyria, Babylonia, and Persia. And these shaped a lot of Old Testament history, because for much of Old Testament history, one or more of these were controlled, had hegemony over the Hebrew people or the Israelite people. So we'll take those one at a time. Again, just to review, Egypt's here. The Nile River, Sinai, and then the land between, or the sacred bridge, and then Mesopotamia, which again, the Tigris and Euphrates River helped spawn these great empires over here. And in the middle, the desert, very almost impassable, so all travel and commerce had to go along the coast. All right. The first people I want to talk about are, again, a local Levantine people, the indigenous people that were here before the Israelites, and those are the Canaanites. And the Canaanites lived, it says in Scripture, in the valleys and along the shoreline of the Mediterranean. And they were Semitic people, like the Israelites. And if the Canaanites did anything, probably their greatest heritage is the alphabet. We can thank the Canaanites for developing an alphabet, which greatly simplified writing compared to cuneiform and pictographs. Now, the early Canaanite writing was also in cuneiform. Here's an Ugaritic tablet here. But they used 30 symbols or 30 letters, and that was it, not thousands of different symbols like the Mesopotamian peoples did. And so that simplified it greatly. The Canaanites were polytheists and worshipped a pantheon of gods and goddesses, including Baal and El, their main god, and Ashtart and Molech and other gods and goddesses. Another characteristic of the Canaanites was that they lived in Lebanon, and that was famous for the great cedars of Lebanon, groves of which still exist today. Here's one here, and those were lumberjacks used those and cut those down for building projects throughout history, early history, including Solomon's Temple. But the Assyrians also had cedar of Lebanon shipped over to Assyria to adorn their buildings and interiors as well. Another thing about the Canaanites is they were traders. They were merchants. In fact, the name Canaan means merchant. And they were excellent sailors. And their ships plied the Mediterranean. And they had Canaanite settlements, Phoenician settlements, all the way to the Pillars of Hercules or the Rock of Gibraltar, right at the western edge of the Mediterranean, and everywhere in between. Carthage is, again, a very famous Phoenician city that began its own empire, its own regional empire, as well as these other sites as well. Cyprus, Sicily, and Crete, all of these had Canaanite settlements and influence. Now, Canaanites versus Phoenicians, essentially the same people, just different names. Phoenicians, again, were northern Canaanites north of the land of Israel in what's now Lebanon and Syria. Below here is the royal tombs at Ugarit. We'll talk about Ugarit on the next slide. But the finds at Ugarit very much defined and shaped our understanding of Canaanite culture. In the late 1920s, a Syrian farmer was plowing and hit antiquities, and the French, who again had a mandate over Syria at that time, were called in, and they started excavating, I believe in 1929, and uncovered an immense Canaanite city at a place called Ras Shamra, and this is ancient Ugarit. And Ugarit on this map here is way to the northern part of Syria. Now, along with palaces and temples, they found a cache of tablets, cuneiform tablets. And these were sent to Jerusalem to be deciphered, and they couldn't make sense out of it because it was not cuneiform that they were used to from Assyria or Babylon, so to speak, until one student recognized that there was only 30 different symbols. And this was actually an alphabetic cuneiform script, and they discovered essentially a new language, a Canaanite language, very, very similar to Hebrew, cognate of Hebrew, and other West Semitic languages, but only written in cuneiform. Early, again, this Ugarit and Ugaritic dates to the second millennium BC. It was destroyed by the invasions of the Sea Peoples, among them the Philistines, and never rebuilt, essentially. And so the remains are extensive and in a good state of preservation because it wasn't constantly built over and built upon like at other sites. Now, Canaanite tablets or Ugaritic tablets written in Ugaritic opened a huge window in our understanding of Old Testament accounts, specifically the Book of Psalms. And we see the Book of Psalms using similar language, only instead of Baal or Molech or El, you have Yahweh doing these great things. And so some scholars, including Mitchell Dahoud, were famous for making connections between Ugaritic and the poetic passages in the Book of Psalms. And some of these, again, have been in various collections. The most common here is Stories from Ancient Canaan, still in print by one of Frank Moore Cross's students. Just a final word about Ugarit and Ugaritic. The Canaanite culture and places like Ugarit had a great influence, negative influence, on the Israelite people. And one of those was played out in the biblical text by King Ahab of Israel marrying a Phoenician princess, Queen Jezebel. And her seal, which I can bounce back two slides, which I didn't mention, is here. Again, its authenticity is debated, but that may be the actual seal of Jezebel, the queen of Israel. And she was Phoenician or Canaanite in background, and we all know about the infamous actions that she did in the Book of Kings. Okay, we move ahead now to our first global empire, and that is Egypt. Mitzrayim, the land of the pharaohs. A very dramatic sunset over the pyramids here at Giza. And it helps to understand, and we'll probably say this again when we talk about the patriarchs, and Abraham and Sarah came to Egypt in Genesis chapter 12 because of famine. These pyramids were standing at that time, and they were 400 to 500 years old. So when we talk about the pyramids, which are Old Kingdom tombs, royal tombs and tombs of officials, that's an extremely ancient monuments for the pharaohs. Just a little introduction about Egypt. Ancient Egyptians called their land the Black Land, and that was a land on either side of the Nile River that extended way to the south, the surrounding land, the Black Land again, was the arable land, the land that was rich with irrigation and could grow food. The surrounding land was the Red Land, the desert, which are on both sides of the Nile Valley. And so that was very, very telling explanation on how Egyptians described themselves. Now, Egypt in antiquity was quite isolated. Again, surrounded by deserts on all sides, the Arabian Desert, the Sierra Desert to the west, the Sinai Peninsula and the desert to the east, as well as the Eastern Desert, and to the south, the various cataracts, the rapids of the Nile, and deserts in Nubia, and which is modern Sudan, basically isolated it from the rest of the surrounding nations and empires. So it grew and developed pretty much in isolation, and that's important to point out. Secondly, there are two Egypts. There's Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt, again, think downriver. The Nile is one of the few rivers in the world that actually flows to the north. So downriver, Lower Egypt is to the north. Upper Egypt is upriver to the south. And these had independent kings, Upper and Lower Egypt, and it wasn't until the Old Dynasty, the reign of Narmer, Pharaoh Narmer, that these two, Upper and Lower Egypt, were united. And you have the double crown from the Pharaoh there, that they were united into one kingdom. And that was, again, early in the Old Kingdom. Now notice that the arable land along the Nile was only about 12 miles wide. And so that was the lifeline. That was the life of Egypt. Without the Nile River, Egypt was desert. There was nothing there. So the Nile River was very, very important. It was vital to the economy and to the livelihood of the people. Okay. Egyptian chronology. There's two different chronologies for Egypt based on ancient sources, but these are the ones we'll use. The Old Kingdom, you can see the dates there, this 3rd millennium B.C. Upper and Lower Egypt are united. And this is the age of the pyramids. This is when the pyramids were built. And this was a way of monumental commemoration of their pharaohs by building these huge, huge, immense pyramids. That was followed by a period called the First Intermediate Period. This was a period of, there were three of these, and these were periods of internal conflict and weak pharaohs and maybe competing pharaohs for control. And so that was, again, the first intermediate period, about a century. And then the Middle Kingdom, again, Egypt became strong again. And either the end of the first intermediate period or the early part of the Middle Kingdom was the age of the patriarchs. And we'll see more evidence of that later on in this slide series and in another lecture as well. The second intermediate period was a period where Egypt was ruled by foreigners, Asiatics. The Greeks called their names Hyksos, rulers of a foreign land, or shepherd kings. You hear different terms for them. But these were Asiatics, Canaanites, so to speak, that actually ruled Lower Egypt, the Delta area. Now, some scholars have said this is probably the ideal time to place Joseph as he goes down to Egypt and serves under Potiphar as a slave, and then eventually, as you know, becomes vizier of Egypt under Pharaoh. It could have been here, or it could have been in the Middle Kingdom. There's arguments and evidence for both, so we just simply don't know. We do know that when Joseph died, and after Joseph died, a new king ruled over Egypt, and who did not know Joseph, and that's when the Israelite oppression began. So that's probably the biblical way of explaining a new dynasty or new kingdom. And this would have been the new kingdom, which is when Egypt was at its strongest, at its height of power, lasted from about 1550 to 1069 BC. This is the period of the sojourn and the Exodus. And the late part of that would be the period of the judges. Now, the necropolis of the new kingdom was the Valley of the Kings near across the Nile from Karnak, which is to the south. Now the New Kingdom, again, Egypt at its height of power, fell into, again, a period of turmoil called the Third Intermediate Period. And these were, Egypt was ruled by Libyan pharaohs, by Cushite pharaohs, and competing pharaohs. And this allowed Israel, one of the reasons why Israel became strong under the United Monarchy under David and Solomon, and during the early divided monarchy, because Egypt was in turmoil and really not a player on the world stage. At the same time, so was Assyria. So there was a period of kind of a power vacuum. And as one of my professors used to say, when the cat's away, the mice will play. And so when the empires are weak, then regional kingdoms can flourish and expand. And that's what happened during the 10th century. Now that was followed by the Saint period, the last period of Egyptian power under the late period, the last few dynasties up to the 30th dynasty. And that lasted until 525, all the way down to the death of Cleopatra, when Egypt became a fully Roman control. Now, the list of Egyptian interactions with Israel, you can see Genesis 12, Abraham 37 through 50, Joseph, the Exodus, 1st and 2nd Kings, and so on. And Egyptian pharaohs are named after Shishak. But before Shishak, this is important for historians, they are not named. Why is that? And this has been an agonizing issue for biblical historians and Egyptologists from time immemorial, because we don't know the name of the pharaoh of the Exodus. We don't know the name of the pharaoh that interacted with Abraham and Sarah. And we don't know the pharaoh that let his daughter marry Solomon. Solomon married Pharaoh's daughter. Who were these pharaohs? Well, we can guess, and we can use a lot of conjecture and make suggestions. But again, this is still debated. Why is that? Why didn't the Bible name names? Well, again, in Hebrew thought, Old Testament thought, when you name a person, they have stature. And because the Pharaoh of the Exodus was impotent, you think of the 10 plagues, and we'll talk about this later, maybe in more detail. An impotent Pharaoh is not worthy of a name, and so this was done theologically, I believe, in part. So unfortunately for history, we don't have the Pharaoh's name. Now, recently, I was in Egypt. Last month, and there's a beautiful new museum there where they have all the royal mummies on display. And I went around and looked at every mummy, every pharaoh that they have, and I am certain that I looked into the eyes, or maybe the eye sockets, of the pharaoh of the Exodus. But was that Amenhotep III? Was that Tutmosis III? Amenhotep II? Whatever. Ramses II? We don't know. We don't know for certain. But I am fairly certain I saw the mummy of the Pharaoh of the Exodus. Another, chart showing the different dynasties of the ancient Egyptian kings. And that goes all the way up to actually the 31st dynasty, or the 30th dynasty, and then on into the Ptolemaic period until the Romans took over. Okay. Egypt has an important role to play in the Old Testament. There's Egyptian influence in the Old Testament. And we have to understand, too, that in the New Testament, Mary and Joseph fled Bethlehem with the infant Jesus and sojourned in Egypt until Herod the Great died. And then it was safe to come back and settle in Nazareth. And you see that, prophesied in Hosea. And you see that beautiful parallelism between the oppression and the exodus from Egypt, and then that done again during the early years of Jesus by his parents. So a lot of interesting connections here. We'll talk about Pharaoh Merneptah, who actually mentions Israel. It's the first time Israel is mentioned by a foreign power in his stela. And Pharaoh Shishak, who left part of his stela in the Holy Land at Megiddo. And a Pharaoh that actually killed a king of Judah, Josiah at Megiddo, Pharaoh Necho in 609, and so on and so forth. Other Egyptian influence in the Old Testament, you can see names. Moses, of course, Hophni and Phinehas, the sons of Eli the priest, had Egyptian names. And a number of Proverbs have close Egyptian parallels as well. So there's a lot of Egyptian parallels in the Old Testament. This is a famous tomb painting that, we'll revisit when we talk about the patriarchs. But this is, again, 12th dynasty pharaoh, Sesostris, his tomb. You've got these murals on the wall of his tomb showing Canaanites or Asiatics bringing goods to trade, copper ingots and animals to Egypt to trade. And you notice the different hairstyles, the different beards, the lighter colored skin, and the colorful garments. Of course, you immediately think of Joseph in the coat of many colors. This dates to about 1892. Again, definitely within, I believe, the patriarchal period. So if you want a depiction of what Abraham looked like, and Sarah, this is a good clue of what they look like from these depictions on this tomb face. During the second intermediate period, that we have the rule of the Hyksos in Egypt, the Canaanites or Asiatics that ruled Egypt for about a century. And this was their capital, again in the Nile Delta, again lower Egypt, the northern part of Egypt. And this is a place called Avaris. And Avaris has been excavated for many years by an Austrian expedition. And they have found some very interesting finds there, one of which is a tomb of a vizier and a destroyed statue. Much has been made out of this, possibly being the tomb of Joseph. It's a reconstruction of what that statue probably looked like. And the question is, are we looking into the face of Joseph? Well, maybe, maybe not, but that gives us a good indication of what Joseph probably looked like in his Egyptian garb. In Exodus, we talk about two store cities built by the Israelites, Ramses and Pithom. And one of these was excavated in the 1970s by, again, John Holliday and Telus Mascuda. And that's a picture of the excavations going on there. Picture of the Temple of Karnak and the face of Pharaoh Thutmose III, very likely the Pharaoh of the Exodus in the 18th dynasty, but we're not certain. And the Egyptian Empire at its height under Thutmose III, Egypt expanded, again went through this narrow corridor, the southern Levant, up to the Euphrates River and placed a stela there, showing the northern extent of their empire. And that happened again during the 18th dynasty when Egypt was at its height. Another interesting reign to talk about in ancient Egypt is the reign of Akhenaten or Amenhotep IV, who was a heretic pharaoh because he rejected the pantheon or the Egyptian religious system and worshipped one god. He was a monotheist. That god, however, was Aten, the sun. Here's a picture of him kissing his baby, his wife, Nefertiti, and Nefertiti, and the sun, Aten, shining up down upon them. His wife, very famous bust of his wife, Nefertiti, and this is, again, an artist's depiction or photograph of what she would have looked like. He moved the capital, and we'll go into detail here later when we talk about the Exodus, from Luxor and Karnak downriver to a place called Tel El Amarna. So Akhetaten is the name of the new capital that he built. And it's kind of interesting. He built this from scratch, apparently. And there's mountains in the desert, both to the west and to the east. And right where he built his new capital, there is V notches in each of the surrounding mountains to the west and to the east. So he can see the full extent of the sun as it rises and as it sets on the horizon. Because, again, he worshipped the sun as the sole god. Now, did he get this idea of monotheism from the Hebrews? Again, that's a debatable subject. What was found at Tell el-Amarna when it was excavated, and even before it was excavated, was the Egyptian Foreign Office under Akhenaten. And he was so interested in his new religion, and he kind of apparently neglected Egyptian foreign policy and his troops that were abroad. So he received and sent a series of dispatches, diplomatic correspondence, between vassal kings and his government. And these were collected and placed in the Foreign Office archives and discovered in the late 19th century, at first by Egyptians trying to get fertilizer for their farms. And they found these small clay tablets that had cuneiform writing on it. It was Akkadian. And so they took them to Cairo to get some money for them, and that's what got the interest of the archaeologists. And eventually they have found, to date, or know of, 382 of these tablets from, again, the Foreign Office of Akhenaten and perhaps some of the pharaohs before him. And these have been published very well by William Moran and Anson Rainey in different publications. And they tell very, very dramatically what this geopolitical situation is in various areas of Egypt and in the, more importantly, in the Levant. And they have, again, correspondence from the kings of Shechem, Labayu, the kings of Jerusalem, the kings of Gezer. And so you have insights, very valuable insights, into the geopolitical goings-on, so to speak, in Canaan. And this is right during the general period of the Exodus and conquest. So very interesting to study these. And again, very, very good editions out there for people to read. 19th dynasty is a later dynasty. And again, this is totally dominated by the reign of Ramses II. Look at his dates. Very, very long reign that he had. And he was a master builder, temples and temples and statues and monumental architecture all over Egypt. But his son, as important as Ramses was, and a lot of people believe he could be the Pharaoh of the Exodus, his son, after Ramses' death, he was well over 90 years old. His son, Merneptah, also did some activity, foreign activity, and worked on the temple at Karnak. But he also had foreign expeditions as well. And the Merneptah Stela is very, very famous because it mentions him attacking and eliminating Israelites. Israel is laid waste, his seed is no more. And again, that dates to about 1205 BC. And probably, most definitely for now, is the first clear reference to Israel by a non-biblical source. And there's a picture of him there. Now, in the late 80s, Frank Yurko, University of Chicago, studied the reliefs on the walls of the Karnak Temple, and recognized that some of these were made by Merneptah, and he claims that these figures here represent the Israelites that are mentioned on Merneptah's stela. So we have, in essence, the first depictions, artistic depictions, of the Israelites in Canaan, in the land of Israel, by the Egyptians. And that's, again, 1205 B.C., so to speak. There's his mummy and one of his statues as well. And again, the Merneptah stela and the surrounding, it's basically a chant that he wrote. It's poetry, poetic. And it talks about the various lands that he conquered, or various peoples he conquered. And you can see Ashkelon mentioned, Gezer, Yanoam, and then Israel, which seems to place her right in the hill country, which would be where she would naturally be, according to the Bible. And again, these are hyperbole here. He probably ran over a few Israelite farmers with his chariots, didn't wipe her out, didn't take away her ability to procreate, but again, hyperbolic language on a victory stela to enhance his reputation back home in Egypt. There's an interesting passage, interesting text in Joshua, Joshua 15:9. And again, this is part of the boundary description of the various provinces or districts of the tribe of Judah. And here it reads, from the hilltop, the boundary headed towards the spring of the waters of Nephtoah, came out of the towns of Mount Ephron and went down towards Baalah, that is Kiriath Yearim. Okay, the waters of Nephtoah, we can recognize those as being west of Jerusalem. It's today called Liphtah. And it's really the first major spring west of ancient Jerusalem. But the strange name here is Waters of Nephtoah. Again, in construct form in Hebrew, you would say Me Nephtoah. And you can see the corruption there possibly of Merneptah. And so that could be possibly a corruption very early in Israelite history of a place named after Merneptah. Me Nephtoah, Merneptah. Okay. Now, more than that, parts of a Egyptian stela and libation table were found outside of the old city of Jerusalem. Again, Egyptian, clearly Egyptian style, including some lotus capitals as well. And it's the opinion of one of my teachers, Gabi Barkai, that there was actually an Egyptian temple outside of the city of Jerusalem to the north during the New Kingdom, probably during the reign of Merneptah. So you've got little pieces of evidence, some alabaster vessels found in that same excavation at St. Stephen's, Ecole Biblique, back in the 19th century. And these seem to add up to possibly an Egyptian temple or administrative center there, possibly established by Merneptah, maybe earlier. Okay, the Bible has these comments on Egypt that we need to read, and you can understand that if you understand the context that they were written in. Hosea, the beautiful quote from Hosea, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." Again, looking backwards to the Exodus, to the nation of Israel being called out of Egypt, but also looking forward to God's only son, Jesus Christ, being called out of Egypt with his parents at the death of Herod and coming back to the land of Israel and settling in Nazareth so he can complete his mission. Also in the Old Testament, there was a kind of a lingering interest in Egypt and hope that the Egypt of old would come to the rescue of Israel when Israel was being oppressed by the Babylonians. And God warns his people, Israel, and says the following, "Behold, you are trusting now in Egypt that broken reed of a staff, which will pierce the hand of any man who leans on it, such as Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who trust in him." So the great, powerful empire of Egypt, by this time, during the third intermediate period, is being called a broken reed of a staff. Again, kind of a touching motif because papyrus reeds grow so plentiful in the Nile Delta. And that is the extent of how Egypt has declined in power and importance and prestige by the time of the late monarchy. All right, we move on now to another empire, and that is the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Neo-Assyrian Empire, again, is based first in Kala and Asshur, the earlier capitals, and then Nineveh. And it, again, encompasses all of Mesopotamia up into Urartu, towards the Black Sea, and then down, again, towards the southern Levant. And later kings, this is a 8th century political map, 8th century BC, later Assyrian kings Ashurbanipal and Esarhaddon conquer Egypt. So for a short period of time, the Neo-Assyrian Empire was a global empire that covered all of the Fertile Crescent down into Egypt. And it was a very brutal empire, as we'll see here in a minute. Usually based at Nineveh for most of its history, it was a huge, huge city. And towards the west, expansion began in earnest, and there was expeditions there earlier. But a king by the name of Shalmaneser III, and we'll see and talk about him a little bit more when we see the Black Obelisk on another segment video segment of this course. Shalmaneser III was a 9th century Assyrian king who fought a huge battle at a place called Karkar in Syria against a whole coalition of regional kings led by Ahab of Israel. We know the exact date of this because of Assyrian records, 853 BC. And of course, Shalmaneser III claimed victory. But at best, this was a draw or a defeat for Assyria because he did not campaign for a number of years out west after that battle. And he claims the Israelite king Ahab had thousands of chariots and men. This is probably an exaggeration, but it was a defeat, more than likely, or a bloody draw that forced Shalmaneser away from the southern Levant for a number of years. Now later on, Jehu overthrew the Omri dynasty after the death of Ahab, and it was at that year, in 841 BC, that Shalmaneser returned to the Levant and set up his headquarters on Mount Carmel, and all the surrounding kings, including Jehu of Israel, had to give vassal act as vassals and give presents and plunder to their new overlord. Now, in the early 8th century, the Assyrians went into decline. And that probably roughly 50-year period allowed these regional kingdoms to renew their prosperity and expand their borders. And Israel did this under Jeroboam II, as Judah did under Uzziah. And this is basically the background for the prophecy or the prophetic book of Jonah, and who was told by the Lord to go to Nineveh and preach and evangelize. And at this time, Nineveh again was, or Assyria was very, very weak, but he had success in Nineveh and many came to the Lord, many Gentiles, Assyrians. But that all changed with the accession of Tiglath-Pileser III, who was an Assyrian king that, again, reasserted Assyrian control over the Levant. And he came with a powerful army and annexed Israel and made Judah a vassal. And his successor, Shalmaneser V and Sargon II, both of them spelled the end of the northern kingdom of Israel. And Samaria fell in 722, and most of the Israelites were deported. It's important to understand that Assyrian kings were masters of psychological warfare. They used terror tactics, and they were brutal in their treatment of prisoners and subjects that were disloyal. And what they would do, if they conquered a country that or a kingdom that revolted against them, they would deport most of the population, almost all the population, to the other side of the empire, and then import foreign peoples from other parts of the empire into the region, and that way it would separate the people from their land, from their homeland, and after a generation or two, they would essentially be loyal Assyrian subjects. They would be speaking the language and assuming the cultural and religious beliefs of the Assyrians. That was the idea. And that didn't always work, but it seemed to work with the Israelites because they were never a recognizable entity again. Now, after Sargon II died in battle in Anatolia, he was succeeded by Sennacherib. Sennacherib was perhaps the most important king, Assyrian king, in relation to biblical history because he was the king that attacked Judah. After the death of Sargon, again, all the kingdoms revolted. Sennacherib came in 701 and attacked Judah because Judah under Hezekiah revolted. And Sennacherib erected prisms and proclaimed very proudly that 46 cities of Judah were destroyed and many 200,000 people were deported. However, he never mentions taking Jerusalem, and that's very significant. We'll talk about that when we deal with the 8th century. After him, Ashurbanipal and Esarhaddon. Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal were the last two powerful kings of Judah, or excuse me, kings of Assyria, and they expanded the borders of Assyria into Egypt. After the death of Ashurbanipal, following the civil war, Assyria quickly went into decline, and the Babylonians moved north from Babylon and began gobbling up the Assyrian Empire as it fell in quick succession, the cities of Asher and Kala, and then finally Nineveh in 612. And we have that recorded in the book of Nahum, the fall of Nineveh. And nobody wept because the Assyrians were very, very brutal people. There's a picture or artist rendition of what Nineveh looked like on the Tigris River at its height. Incredible, beautiful buildings. And anyway, again, here's the main Assyrian kings and what they did as they're mentioned in the Bible. And Shalmaneser III, you have this horrible depiction of atrocities that the Assyrians would do. They would take mothers, pregnant mothers, rip them open, pull out their unborn children and bash the children's heads on the rocks while the mother was still alive. Typical, almost stuff you would expect ISIS to do. Well, ISIS is only doing what the ancient Assyrians did before. Tiglath-Pileser mentioned as Pul in 2 Kings 15, talking about gobbling up all of these cities in northern Israel and defeating these cities, falling one after the other as the Assyrians approach the capital of Samaria. Shalmaneser V and Sargon II finally completed the destruction of the northern kingdom. And then, of course, Sennacherib, which we just described, 185,000 of his men died as the angel of death visited the Assyrian camp, and Jerusalem was saved. Esarhaddon and Ashurbanipal are also mentioned. And so this is, a brutal empire that would do horrible things, ruled by fear and terror. But when they fell quickly because they had no allies. Nobody came to their defense. Okay, the first one, Shalmaneser III. This is Karkar, the site of that major battle between Ahab and his coalition and the Assyrian king. We'll talk more about the Black Obelisk when we see our copy in the museum. The Kirkstele, which talks about the Battle of Karkar, and then the close-up of that Black Obelisk, which we have in the museum, and it shows Jehu actually bowing before the Assyrian king, and that is our first depiction of an Israelite king in a contemporary artistic fashion. And this shows the campaigns of Shalmaneser III all the way from Nineveh, all the way down along the coast here into Israel. And you can see the Battle of Karkar in northern Syria, so all of these armies, these regional armies, had to travel all the way up here to meet the Assyrians and probably defeat them. Very, very famous relief found in the palace of Sennacherib at Nineveh, and this shows the destruction of Lachish, Israelite city, or excuse me, a city of Judah. And again, we'll revisit this as we talk about the 8th century. But here we have depictions of Judeans being led off into captivity. Actual Judeans from the kingdom of Judah. And as well as horrible atrocities. Here are people being impaled on poles because they were caught trying to escape. Artist's depiction of what Sennacherib's palace throne room looked like from the excavations. And of course the famous poem by Lord Byron of the destruction of Sennacherib, which we won't read, but beautiful poetry there describing the destruction of the entire army. Ashurbanipal's palace. This is just to give all of you just the idea of the grandeur and the incredible beauty of the Assyrian court. And in that beauty, there was horrible butchery as well. Here's Ashurbanipal and his queen enjoying a party in his garden, drinking wine from their Assyrian-style cups, while over here on the left hangs the decapitated head of one of their enemies, an Arab chieftain that they were fighting. So you've got this beauty. At the same time, you've got this horrible, cruel, macabre scene of decapitated head while they're enjoying their time in the garden. This is, again, a modern photo of a modern Assyrian procession. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, Assyrians today are Iraqi Christians. It's a Christian church, a denomination, so to speak. And this is an Assyrian wedding, and they're again using Assyrian style clothing with a chariot for this ceremony. Now, sadly, many of these people either had to flee Iraq or were killed by ISIS because of their faith. Finally, we have the legacy of Assyria. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, in whose hand the club is the club of my wrath. So you have to understand that the Israelite people of Judah, this is a very difficult quote to swallow, because God was using this despicable people called the Assyrians that were so cruel and inhumane and evil as the rod of his judgment. And Isaiah is telling that to his people, that God has used them to chastise his people because they don't obey. Okay. Anyway, we'll again revisit Assyria as we look at the archaeological evidence for the 9th and 8th and 7th centuries. But Assyria was a very, very powerful empire for several centuries and made a lasting impact on the Levant and on a biblical history. Thank you very much.
This is Dr. Jeffrey Hudon in his teaching on biblical archaeology. This is session number 8, The Geopolitical Arena, Part 1.